You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a 2014 reading of the cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled According to Luke. This is Lecture 3, entitled Buddha's Contribution to Humanity. When we first take in the Luke Gospel, we merely sense its power. We dimly feel that it reveals truly great and mighty spiritual worlds. After what we heard yesterday, we can understand why this is so. Spiritual research shows that the Buddhistic worldview and all its gifts to humankind flowed into the Luke Gospel. In fact, a unique form of Buddhism, comprehensible to the simplest and most naive hearts and minds, issues from this Gospel. From what I explained yesterday, and will clarify further today, you will gather that Buddhism as such, the teachings of the great Buddha, as they first appeared on earth, is a worldview that can be understood only by those who have achieved certain exalted ideas in the pure ether heights of the spirit. A great deal of preparation is required in order to understand Buddhism itself. The Luke Gospel, however, contains the spiritual substance of Buddhism in a form accessible to all human souls who are receptive to the most essential human ideas and concepts. We will be able to explain how this is possible when we fathom the mystery of the Luke Gospel. Nearly 6 centuries elapsed between Buddha's enlightenment and the birth of Jesus. And in the interim, the hard-earned spiritual accomplishments of Buddhism, which now flow from the Luke Gospel, were enhanced or raised to a higher level. Let's reflect on a few examples of how Buddhism is enhanced in the Luke Gospel. Yesterday, we called Buddhism the purest doctrine of compassion and love. From the Buddha's activity, love and compassion streamed toward all beings on earth. A gospel of love and compassion is evident in true Buddhism, like a warm heart sharing all the suffering encountered in the material world of living things. In Buddhism, we encounter love and compassion in the fullest sense of the words. What flows from the Luke Gospel, however, is more than all-encompassing compassion and love. The Luke Gospel moves from compassion and love into pertinent and urgent deeds. While Buddhists aspire to compassion in the truest sense of the word, Christians who emulate the Luke Gospel aspire to active love. Buddhists share the pain of the sick, but the Luke Gospel calls for active intervention and, to the extent possible, healing. Buddhism allows us to understand what moves and enlivens the human soul. But the Luke Gospel issues a remarkable challenge to refrain from judgment, to do more than is done for us, to give more than we receive. Although we encounter Buddhism in its purest, truest form in the Luke Gospel, it is enhanced and elevated by the transformation of love into action. This aspect of Christianity, or of Buddhism enhanced by Christianity, is best described by the warm-hearted author of the Luke Gospel. Of all the evangelists, Luke, having been a physician, was most able to understand Christ Jesus as the healer of body and soul, and to find profound words that speak to the heart. The particular emphasis of Luke's account of the life of Christ Jesus, which is due to his own experience as a healer of bodies and souls, will become ever more apparent as we plumb the depths of the Luke Gospel. Another striking aspect of the Luke Gospel is its ability to move even the most childlike hearts and minds. Remarkably, the Buddha's lofty teachings which are comprehensible only to mature intelligence and seasoned human soul faculties, appear rejuvenated in the Luke Gospel, as if emerging from a fountain of youth. Buddhism strikes us as a mature fruit of the tree of humanity, but in the Luke Gospel we rediscover it as a flower of youth. And we wonder how this rejuvenation occurred. We will find the answer only by looking closely at the teachings of the great Buddha himself. Our anthroposophical preparatory work will permit us to examine through the eyes of the Spirit what moved his soul. First, let us keep clearly in mind that the Buddha evolved from a bodhisattva, that is, from an exalted being who perceived the mysteries of existence. As a bodhisattva, the Buddha participated in the entire evolution of humankind in ancient times. When human beings reappeared in post-Atlantean times and established and developed the first post-Atlantean culture, the Buddha was already there, serving as a mediator between human beings and the spiritual worlds, as I described yesterday. He was already present in Atlantis and even in Lemuria. The very high level of development that he had achieved allowed him to gradually recall, during his 29 years as a bodhisattva, in his final incarnation in India, all aspects of his earlier lives, all of his previous associations. He looked back on his own participation in humankind's evolution, and on the gifts he brought down to human beings from divine spiritual worlds. Yesterday I indicated that even such exalted individualities must recapitulate, if only briefly, what they learned in previous lives. Even the Buddha described his bodhisattva period as a gradual ascent toward spiritual enlightenment, toward ever more perfected spiritual perception. We are told how he described this process to his disciples. To show them the path his soul had traveled in the quest to remember the experiences of earlier incarnations, he said, "For me there was a time, O you monks, when an all-encompassing glow shone toward me from the spiritual world, but I could distinguish nothing, no figures, and no images. My enlightenment was not pure enough. Then I began to be able to see not only light, but also individual figures and images within it. But I could not yet distinguish what these figures and images meant, for my enlightenment was not pure enough. Then I began to recognize that spiritual beings expressed themselves in these images and figures, but I could not yet distinguish which kingdoms of the spiritual world they belonged to, for my enlightenment was not yet pure enough. Then I learned to recognize which kingdoms of the spiritual world these individual spiritual beings belonged to, but I could not yet distinguish either the deeds that earned them their place in the spiritual kingdoms or their states of mind, for my enlightenment was not yet pure enough. Then there came a time when I could distinguish not only the deeds that had elevated these spiritual beings to the kingdoms they occupied, but also their states of mind. But I could not yet distinguish which spiritual beings I myself had lived with in earlier times, or what I had done in their company, for my enlightenment was not yet pure enough. Then came a time when I was able to identify not only the beings in whose company I had spent a particular epoch, but also what I had done with them. I knew what my previous lives had been, for now my enlightenment was pure." This is how the Buddha described his gradual acquisition of knowledge that had to be reacquired in each incarnation according to the conditions of that epoch. in his present incarnation, the way he acquired this knowledge had to conform to his complete descent into a physical human body. When we contemplate the Buddha's description, we sense the significance and greatness of the individuality who incarnated as the son of the king from the Sakya clan. The Buddha also knew, however, that ordinary people, with the kind of perception available to them then and in the near future, would have to renounce the world he had learned to perceive. Only initiates like the Buddha himself were able to behold the spiritual world. Normal human beings lost this possibility as the remnants of ancient clairvoyant perception grew ever smaller. The task of the Buddha, however, was not simply to speak about what initiates knew. Above all, his task was to speak about the forces that were meant to flow from independent human souls. It was not enough for him to point to the results of his own enlightenment. He had to talk about what ordinary human beings could accomplish by continuing to develop their own inner nature as it was constituted at that time. In the course of the Earth's further evolution, human beings would gradually begin to hear the Buddha's teachings speaking to them from their own hearts, from their independent rational minds. The Buddha was the first to state these teachings as a matter of purely human knowledge. But much time would pass before all human souls would mature enough to acquire this knowledge independently. While the Buddha was the first to extract this ability from the depths of human consciousness, others would have to develop it later. Let's consider another example. Today, people internalize the rules of logical thinking in adolescence, and logical thinking is a universal human ability that develops within the individual. But only the great mind of the Greek thinker Aristotle could allow this faculty to emerge for the first time from a human breast. We must distinguish between being the first to extract a faculty from the depths of human consciousness and doing so after humankind has cultivated that faculty for some time. The Buddha's message was among the greatest teachings ever received by humankind. Only the great heart and mind of a bodhisattva, an exalted and illumined being, could transform this message into a matter of direct human experience. Although all human beings would eventually develop the exalted doctrine of compassion, love, and all the related virtues in their own souls, only the most illumined being could be the first to do so. Consequently, the Buddha had to clothe his message in words that were familiar to the human beings of his time and place. As we have already heard, the philosophies of Sankhya and Yoga were taught in ancient India during the Buddha's lifetime. These philosophies supplied the Buddha with familiar terms and expressions in which to clothe the new teachings that lived in his soul. Although he gave these ideas and concepts totally due forms, he had to use them because any evolutionary step must allow the future to build on the past. Thus the Buddha clothed his sublime wisdom in the familiar expressions of contemporary Indian teachings. We must attempt to grasp how the Buddha himself experienced the teaching that humanity would eventually internalize. What thoughts can even approximate the profound soul experiences that passed through the Buddha's heart and mind as he sat under the Bodhi tree during the 7 days of his enlightenment? His thoughts ran somewhat as follows. In very early stages of human evolution, many people possessed a dull and dim clairvoyance, and in still earlier times, everyone was clairvoyant. being clairvoyant means being able to use one's astral organs. If we use only the organs of the astral body, however, we sense and feel the most profound mysteries, but cannot behold them. Clairvoyant perception begins only when astral experience leaves an impression on the ether body. In ancient times, human beings possessed a dull form of clairvoyance because they were still able to use the organs of the ether body, which at that time had not fully penetrated the physical body. Over time, human beings gradually accepted the loss of the use of their etheric organs and learned to rely exclusively on the physical body's material organs to transmit thoughts, sensations, feelings, and ideas to the astral body. All this passed through the great soul of the Buddha. He knew that human beings had lost the use of their etheric organs, and that the astral body allowed them to experience what the instruments of the physical body transmitted from the outer world. Then the Buddha asked himself an important question. Under normal circumstances, when the eye senses the color red, when the ear hears a sound, or when the sense of taste has an impression of flavor, these sensations are transformed into mental images and experienced in the astral body. If we experienced them in no other way, they would not normally cause pain and suffering. If we simply surrendered to the impressions of the outer world that affect our senses, to the impressions of colors, light intensity, sounds, and so forth, we would make our way through the world without experiencing pain and suffering as a result of such impressions. We experience pain and suffering only under specific conditions. The great Buddha then proceeded to investigate the causes of pain and suffering, sorrow and worry. When do impressions of the outer world become painful? Why do they become painful under certain circumstances? The Buddha realized that when we look back into ancient times, we discover beings who worked from two directions on the inner nature of human beings, that is, on the human astral body, during our earlier earthly incarnations. During incarnations in the Lemurian and Atlantean periods, the so-called Luciferic beings worked on human nature. And, as time passed, their impressions and influences were absorbed into the human astral body. Beginning in Atlantean times, humans were also influenced by beings under the leadership of Ahriman. Thus, in previous incarnations, people were influenced by both the so-called Luciferic and the so-called Ahrimanic powers. If these beings had not influenced us, we would never have acquired freedom, free will, or the ability to distinguish between good and evil. From a higher standpoint, it is fortunate that we were influenced by these beings. But in a certain respect, they forced us to descend more deeply into sensory existence than we would otherwise have done as we left the divine spiritual heights. The great Buddha was aware that human beings had incorporated certain influences that are the legacy of both Luciferic and Ahrimanic activity. We carry these influences within us. They began in earlier incarnations and persist even today. When the dimly clairvoyant human beings of ancient times beheld the spiritual world, they saw the harmful influences of Lucifer and the influences of Ahriman in the astral world, and could distinguish precisely where they came from. Their clairvoyant abilities enabled people of those times to make allowances for such influences and protect themselves against them. They also knew how they had come into contact with those beings. At one time, so said the Buddha, people had known the source of the influences they had carried with them from one incarnation to the next, since ancient times. Knowledge of the luciferic and Ahrimanic powers was lost, however, along with the ancient clairvoyants. Since people were no longer clairvoyant, they no longer knew what influenced their souls from incarnation to incarnation. Earlier clairvoyant knowledge was replaced by lack of knowledge, and human beings were overcome by darkness. Although we carry the influence of Lucifer and Ahriman as they did, we no longer know the source of this influence. We carry with us something we know nothing about. Of course, it would be simplistic to deny that something is real and effective simply because we know nothing about it. The influences that entered us over the course of our incarnations are still at work. They are still there. They remain effective throughout our life, but we know nothing about them. This is what the great Buddha realized. How do these influences work in human beings? Although we cannot recognize them, we feel and sense them. There is a force within each of us that comprises all the aspects of the self that persist from incarnation to incarnation, culminating in our present existence. We fail to recognize the true nature of this force. It is our desire for material life, our longing for worldly perception, our thirst or desire for life. Thus the old luciferic and Ahrimanic influences continue to work in human beings as the thirst for existence or the desire to exist, which persists from incarnation to incarnation. This is approximately what the great Buddha said, although he explained it to his closest pupils in greater detail. To understand the Buddha's descriptions of his experience requires a certain amount of spiritual scientific preparation. We know that after the capital I and astral body leave the ether body and the physical body at death, we experience a great tableau, a single mighty image of memories of our life. We know that most of the ether body is then discarded like a second corpse, leaving behind an extract or essence of itself, so to speak. We carry this extract with us through Kamaloka and the time we spend in the Devakan, and then bring it back with us into our next existence. During Kamaloka, however, all our deeds that require karmic compensation are inscribed on this etheric extract that persists from one incarnation to the next. This extract of our previous ether body contains everything that persists from one incarnation to the next. We carry it with us when we re-enter earthly existence at birth. In Oriental literature, what we call the ether body is usually called linga sharira. Thus, what we carry from one incarnation to the next is an extract of linga sharira. The Buddha then asked his disciples to consider human beings who have just been born. Burdens remaining from earlier incarnations are inscribed in the linga sharira that they bring with them. In our current epoch, we know nothing about its contents, which are hidden from us by the darkness of ignorance. As soon as we enter earthly life, these contents assert themselves as the thirst for existence, the desire for life. The Buddha saw the so-called desire for life as everything that originates in earlier incarnations and drives human beings to covet enjoyment of the world, to actively desire the material world instead of remaining unattached observers of its colors, sounds, and other sensory impressions. This tendency or force in human beings comes from earlier incarnations. The Buddha's pupils called it samskara. The Buddha told his closest disciples that people of the present are typically unaware of this important element within themselves. Ignorance transforms this element, which we would otherwise recognize as coming from luciferic and Ahrimanic beings, into the thirst for existence and all the dark, dormant forces persisting from earlier incarnations. The character of our thinking, the fact that objective thinking is not a matter of course for human beings in this epoch of evolution, is due to these forces, which the Buddhist tradition calls samskara. Please note this subtle distinction between objective thinking, which has only its object in view, and thinking influenced by forces from the linga sharira. When you develop opinions, to what extent are they based on your liking for the object of your consideration, and to what extent on objective observation? In Buddhist terms, truths acquired not through objective thinking about a subject, but as the result of old inclinations from earlier incarnations, form an inner thought organ, in quotes. This organ consists of everything we think as a consequence of specific experiences in earlier incarnations. Remnants of these experiences persist in the linga sharira. In each human being, the Buddha saw an inner thought organ formed by the totality of samskara. He said that this thought substance, and it alone, causes the development of the current individuality, which Buddhism calls nama-rupa, or, quote, name and form, close quote. A different philosophical school of thought calls it ahamkara. The Buddha told his pupils that in ancient times, when human beings still clairvoyantly perceived the spiritual world that underlies physical existence, everyone saw the same thing, because the objective world is the same for all. But when the darkness of ignorance spread over the face of the earth, people began to develop individual potentials that distinguished them from each other. Each individual became a being with a soul of a specific form, and each had a distinguishing name, or ahamkara. The inner consequences of our earlier incarnations possess, quote, name and form, close quote, or individuality, and shape our so-called six organs, manas and the five sensory organs, from the inside outward. Please note, however, that the Buddha did not say that the IYE, for example, is formed exclusively from the inside outward. He said that the eye incorporates an element that is contained in the linga sharira and comes from previous levels of existence. For this reason, the eye does not see purely. Our eyes would see differently in the world of material existence if they did not contain remnants from earlier levels of existence. The same is true of our hearing and other senses, which are all contaminated by the desire to see, hear, taste, or otherwise perceive specific things. The so-called desire, remaining from earlier incarnations, creeps into everything our senses encounter in this incarnation. The Buddha said that without this desire from earlier incarnations, we would behold the world like divine beings, taking it in without desiring or coveting anything that is not freely offered to us. Our knowledge would not exceed what the divine powers grant us. We would not distinguish between ourselves and the outer world but would experience ourselves as members of that world. We experience ourselves as separate from the rest of the world only because we desire something more than or different from the enjoyments that the rest of the world freely offers us. This desire awakens our awareness of being different. If we were content with the world as it is, we would not distinguish ourselves from it. We would experience it as an extension of our own existence. We would never experience so-called contact with the outer world. We would not be separate from it, so we couldn't contact it. Contact with the outer world developed gradually as our six organs developed. Contact triggered what we call sensation, and sensation in turn caused us to cling to the outer world. Clinging to the outer world, however, causes pain, suffering, worry, and sorrow. This is how the Buddha described the inner human being, who causes pain and suffering, sorrow and worry in our world. His is a sensitive, exalted theory, but it springs directly from life because an, in quotes, enlightened one sensed it as a profound truth about contemporary human beings. When he became the Buddha, this bodhisattva, who had spent thousands of years guiding humanity toward the doctrine of compassion and love, discovered the true nature and cause of suffering in contemporary human beings. He saw the cause of suffering and explained it to his closest pupils. The famous sermon at Benares that launched his activity as the Buddha summed up his experience of the essential kernel of contemporary human existence. He preached a popular form of what he had conveyed to his pupils in a more intimate setting, saying that if we recognize the causes of human existence, we know that life must include suffering and pain. His first lesson was the doctrine of suffering in the world. The second is the doctrine of the causes of suffering. Suffering is caused by the desire or thirst for existence, the stealthy remnants of earlier incarnations. Thirsting for existence is the cause of suffering. The third lesson is how to eliminate suffering from the world. Of course, suffering can be eliminated by eliminating its cause, that is, by extinguishing the thirst for existence that results from ignorance. The Buddha said that we have abandoned ancient clairvoyant knowledge for a state of ignorance that hides the spiritual world from us. Ignorance is to blame for the thirst for existence, which in turn causes suffering and pain, worry and sorrow. To eliminate these misfortunes from the world, the thirst for existence must disappear. The old knowledge has vanished, and people can no longer use their etheric organs. We can acquire new knowledge, however, through total immersion in what the astral body's deepest forces can supply with the help of physical sense perceptions. The gift of knowledge is acquired only through astral observation, which places demands on the physical body, but cannot be developed through physical disciplines. This is approximately what the Buddha said in his first great public speech. He knew that he had to communicate the knowledge that can be achieved by developing the astral body's forces to the utmost through mighty meditative effort. Knowledge thus achieved is appropriate to the present human condition and has nothing to do with influences from earlier incarnations. The Buddha offered knowledge that had nothing to do with the darkness and ignorance of samskara, which slumbers in the human soul. He wanted to exemplify the knowledge that can be acquired by awakening all the astral body's forces in a single incarnation. The Buddha said suffering in the world is caused by human ignorance of a remnant that persists from earlier incarnations. This remnant causes the ignorance prevalent in the world. It also causes human suffering and pain, worry and sorrow. But when we become aware of our astral forces, we can choose to acquire knowledge that does not depend on anything in the past. This is the knowledge the great Buddha attempted to convey in the so-called Eightfold Path. Contemporary individuals who develop the forces he presents in this path achieve knowledge that is not influenced by repeated rebirth. The Buddha himself raised his soul to the highest level accessible to the astral body's strongest forces. In the Eightfold Path, he wanted to show humankind the route to knowledge uninfluenced by samskara. He said that we achieve this type of knowledge by acquiring right views that have nothing to do with sympathy, antipathy, or personal bias. We develop such views purely on the basis of what is presented to us from outside, that is, on the basis of the object's own forces. Right views or right understanding of issues is the first step on the Eightfold Path. As a second step, we must become independent of persistent remnants of previous incarnations. We must attempt to form judgments based on right views rather than on any other influences. Right judgment is the second step. The third is to express our right views and right judgments correctly when we convey them to the world. We refrain from introducing anything other than our right views into our words and any other expressions of our human nature. This is the right speech of Buddhism. The fourth necessary step is to carry out actions uninfluenced by our sympathies and antipathies, free of the dark rumblings of samskara. We permit only our right views, right judgment, and right speech to affect our deeds. That is right action. The fifth step toward inner liberation is achieving our proper place in the world. What did the Buddha mean by this? Many people are unsatisfied with their task in the world and think they would be better off in a different position. We need to learn, however, to make the best of the situation that is ours through birth or destiny. When we are not content with our station in life, it does not provide the strength we need for appropriate action in the world. The Buddha called this fifth step acquiring the right standpoint. The sixth step is to make a habit of everything we have acquired through right views, right judgment, and so forth. Already, as children, we begin to develop specific habits and inclinations. We must make an effort, however, to give up habits that come from samskara, and to gradually acquire ones that result from right views, right judgment, right speech, and so forth. These are right habits. The seventh step is to order our life by not forgetting yesterday when we act today. If we can learn all our skills anew each time we attempted to do something, we would never accomplish anything. We must always attempt to recollect or remember all aspects of our existence, to evaluate what we have already learned and link the present to the past. This right memory must be acquired on the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. The eighth step is accomplished by allowing neither our preference for a specific opinion nor anything that persists from previous incarnations to interfere with the purity of our contemplation of the objects and events we encounter. We allow the objects and events themselves to speak for themselves. This is right contemplation. This is the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. The Buddha told his disciples that following this path would gradually extinguish the thirst for existence that causes suffering and liberate human souls from all the enslaving remnants of past lives. The description of this path gives us a sense of the spirit and origin of Buddhism. We also recognize the importance of the fact that the Bodhisattva became a Buddha. We know that throughout human evolution, the Bodhisattva always worked to give humankind the faculties related to his mission. In ancient times, before the Buddha walked the earth, human beings were dependent on influences flowing into them from the spiritual worlds. We could not use our inner forces to spontaneously produce right speech or right judgment. Because the Bodhisattva was responsible for the flow of moral spiritual influences, it was a unique event when he became the Buddha and taught people what he had previously accomplished on their behalf. The human body he produced independently developed forces that had previously come only from above. Readers aside, there's an issue with this sentence. I'm going to try to read it this way. The human body he had produced independently developed forces that had previously come only from above. The body of Gautama Buddha was the first human body of this type. As a result, forces that for epochs had streamed down from spiritual heights existed independently on earth. This accomplishment is of great and far-reaching importance for earthly evolution, because these forces are now accessible to all human beings. The ability to develop the forces of the Eightfold Path independently and internally, making them the common possession of all human beings, originated in the body of Gautama Buddha. The very fact that the Buddha began a process that will eventually enable all of humankind to accomplish the steps of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha gave human beings the spiritual nourishment he himself had internalized. In general, such events are not examined by today's material science. Instead, they are often recounted by childlike legends and fairy tales. I have emphasized repeatedly and in many different contexts that fairy tales and legends are often wiser and more scientific than our objective scholarship. Human souls have always sensed a very special truth in the presence of a being such as a bodhisattva, namely, that a quality they would eventually internalize and radiate back into cosmic space initially streamed into them from above. Those dimly capable of perceiving such facts knew that just as the sun's rays shine in the heavens, the strength of the bodhisattva irradiated the earth with the forces of the doctrine of compassion and love. They knew that when the Bodhisattva incarnated fully in a human body, he bestowed on human beings a possession that had once been his alone. This gift is now alive in humankind and radiates back into cosmic space, just as moonlight reflects the rays of the sun. People have always sensed the exceptional importance of such phenomena and expressed their truths in the form of fairy tales and legends. In the case of the Bodhisattva, a remarkable legend emerged in the areas where he lived, and the great event of his life was clothed in a simple story. The Buddha was once incarnated as a hare at a time when many different creatures searched for food, but went hungry because all the food had been eaten. The plants that the hare ate were not suitable food for meat-eating creatures. The hare, who was actually the Buddha, decided to sacrifice himself as food for a Brahmin who was passing by. At that very moment, the god Shakra appeared and saw the hare's noble deed. A cleft opened in the mountain and swallowed the hare, and the god took ink and painted the hare's image on the moon. Since that time, the image of the Buddha in the form of the hare can be seen on the moon. In the West, as you know, we see the image of the man in the moon instead of the image of a hare. A Kalmuk legend tells this story even more succinctly. The hare that lives on the moon is there because when the Buddha sacrificed himself, the spirit of the earth drew the hare's picture on the moon. These legends express the great truth of how the Bodhisattva became the Buddha, and how the Buddha himself devoted a faculty that had belonged to him alone to serve as nourishment for human beings, so that it can shine from human hearts and irradiate the cosmos. Seers know that the transition from Bodhisattva to Buddha signifies a being's final incarnation on earth. In that final incarnation, the being in question incarnates fully into a human body. The Buddha sensed the significance of his final incarnation on earth. It would be wrong to believe, however, that such a being withdraws totally from earthly existence when he no longer appears in a physical body. He continues to influence life on earth by assuming a body of a different sort. After his final physical incarnation, he works through a body that may be either astral or etheric in nature. Such a being, who no longer descends into a physical body, but still possesses an astral body, can pervade an ordinary human being who has a physical body, an etheric body, an astral body, and an eye. The higher being then acts through that person, who becomes an important personality through the activity of forces belonging to a being whose final earthly incarnation has been completed. Thus, an astral being unites with the astral member of a human being on earth. How this union occurs can be very complicated. When the Buddha appeared to the shepherds in the image of the heavenly hosts, he was present not in a physical body, but in an astral body, through which he continued to influence the earth. We distinguish three types of bodies that a Buddha can assume. The first is the pre-Buddha body, through which a bodhisattva works from above. This body maintains contact with the heights and is associated with a bodhisattva mission prior to its transformation into a Buddha mission. Hence, this body, the Dharmakaya, does not include everything through which such a body acts. The second body, the Sambhogakaya, or body of perfection, fully manifests all the attributes of a bodhisattva in a physical body. The third body is assumed after a bodhisattva achieves enlightenment as a Buddha, and he works down on the earth as described above. This body is called a Nirmanakaya. We can say, therefore, that the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, in the form of the angelic hosts, appeared to the shepherds. The Buddha's radiance streamed into the Nirmanakaya that was revealed to the shepherds. After this appearance, however, the Buddha continued to seek ways of influencing events taking place in Palestine at this very important time. In order to understand the Buddha's ongoing influence, we must briefly recall what anthroposophical lectures have taught us about the nature of the human being. We know that spiritual science distinguishes between several types of birth. In physical birth, an individual sheds the mother's physical covering, as it were, the mother's etheric covering, which surrounds the child until the second dentition, just as her physical body surrounds the infant until physical birth, is discarded in the seventh year of life. At puberty, which presently occurs in the 14th or 15th year of life, the astral covering is discarded. Thus a person's ether body is born as an independent body in the outer world only around age 6, and the astral body is born only at puberty, when the maternal astral covering is shed. Let's look at the astral covering that is discarded at puberty. In Palestine, when the events we are describing took place, puberty typically began earlier, during the 12th year of life, under normal circumstances. That was when the mother's astral covering was discarded. Ordinarily, this covering is shed and surrendered to the outer astral world. In the case of the child who was descended from the priestly branch of the house of David, something else happened. In his 12th year of life, the discarded maternal astral body did not dissolve into the general astral world. Instead, this astral covering, which had protected the young boy from the second dentition to puberty, merged, together with all the enlivening forces that had streamed into it during that period, with the Buddha's descending Nirmanakaya, which had appeared as the heavenly host. The Buddha's Nirmanakaya, which had hovered over and illuminated the child Jesus since his birth, united with the astral covering discarded by the boy Jesus, thus absorbing all the forces that maintain youth in the period between the second dentition and puberty. This rejuvenation made it possible for the Buddha's earlier gift to the world to reappear in the childlike simplicity of the boy Jesus. It enabled the boy to talk in a childlike way about the exalted doctrines of compassion and love that we described today in all their complexity. At his visit to the temple, those around him were astonished at how he spoke, Luke 2:44-50. This unprecedented ability was due to the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, which surrounded the boy and was rejuvenated as if in a fountain of youth by the maternal astral covering he discarded. Spiritual researchers are aware of this mystery that the author of the Luke Gospel wove into the transformation of the 12-year-old Jesus in the temple. Thus, the Luke Gospel teaches a form of Buddhism that is accessible to simple childlike minds. This transformation explains why the boy suddenly spoke differently. His previous manner of speaking was like that of King Kanishka in India, who around the same time called a synod and proclaimed the orthodoxy of ancient Buddhism. The Buddha himself had advanced in the interim, however. He had absorbed the forces of the maternal astral sheath of the child Jesus, which enabled him to speak to human hearts and minds in a new way. Thus the Luke Gospel contains a new Buddhism, rejuvenated as if in a fountain of youth, and states the religion of compassion and love in a way that is easily understandable to the simplest hearts and minds. This mystery is there for us to read, woven into the account of Jesus' life by the author of the Luke Gospel. Today I had time to describe only part of what is actually happening in this scene in the temple. Subsequent lectures will further illuminate the background of this mystery and clarify earlier and later events in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. The end of Lecture 3, given in Basel on September 17, 1909.